Chapter 7. There where they used to stand. In the depths of Abora, Venom is hung suspended in a Bacta tank. Wireless sensors affixed to his narrow chest, neck, and fissured hairless cranium. "You may be Tenebris's most important gift to me," Plagueis said as he watched the Bith's body bob in the thick therapeutic liquid.
"His brain continues to recuperate from the effects of the coma bloom alkaloids,"
114D remarked from the far side of the laboratory. "His physical condition, however, remains stable." Plagueis kept his gaze on Venomous. The wound Venomous's lightsaber had inflicted to Plagueis's neck had healed, but the faint scar was a fresh reminder of his mortality. "That's good, because I'm not interested in his mind." In salute, the droid's new appendages made a surgical slashing motion. Blood analysis had revealed a high midichlorian count, which to Plagueis was further indication that a being could have great potential in the Force and yet still be inept. He wondered, was it Venomous he had felt through the Force after the murder of Tenebris? A Jedi would have made a far more interesting experimental subject, but a dark side adept was perhaps better suited to his purposes. And soon enough, the adjacent Bacta tank would contain a Force-resistant Yenchori as well. Immediately following the contest on Sojourn, Plagueis had commanded members of the Sun Guard to locate the starship that had allowed Venomous to infiltrate the Hunter's Moon, then move it and the poisoned Bith to Abora. Larsh Hill and the other Munes had been apprised that an intruder had been captured and disposed of, but no more than that. An investigation of the ship had yielded data that might have surprised even Darth Tenebris, who had provided the ship. It seemed that well before he had confronted Plagueis or learned of his master's fate, Venomous himself had been scouting for potential apprentices. Plagueis could not help being impressed, though begrudgingly. The young Bith would have done well in Bane's era. Now, however, he was an anachronism and, by extension, Tenebris also. That Tenebris had targeted him came as no shock to Plagueis. He and the Bith had reached an impasse decades earlier regarding execution of the Sith Imperative. The product of one of the galaxy's most ancient civilizations, Tenebris believed that victory could be achieved through a mating of the powers of the dark side and expert Bith science. With the aid of sophisticated computers and future-casting formulas, the varied beings of the galaxy could be provided for, and the Jedi Order would gradually dwindle and disappear. Tenebris had tried to persuade Plagueis that the Force did not play games of chance with the galaxy, and that while the fated ascendancy of the dark side could be predicted, its rise could not be influenced or hurried by the Sith. The Munes believed in formulas and calculations as strongly as the Bith did, but Plagueis was not a fatalist. Convinced that Tenebris's brilliant equations were missing an important factor, he had argued that future events, whether predicted by machines or glimpsed in visions, were often clouded and unreliable. More important, he had been raised to believe in the elimination of competitors and viewed the Jedi as just that. The Order wasn't simply some rival corporation that could be secretly acquired. It had to be undermined, toppled, and dismantled. Deracinated. He had assumed that given time, he would have been able to win Tenebris over, but his former master had obviously pronounced him unfit to don the mantle of Sith's successor, and had looked elsewhere. The unbridled desires of sentience were a blessing to the Sith, for those desires birthed an abundance of zealous and audacious beings who could be used to further the cause. Plagueis had been instructed to be on the lookout for suitable beings, just as Tenebris had been when he had discovered Venomous. Perhaps Tenebris had regarded the sneak attack as beneficial, no matter the results. Had Venomous been victorious, he was deserving of the mantle, and if not, then Plagueis might come to accept the true nature of the master-apprentice relationship. An old story that had never made much sense to him. But it did explain Tenebris's curious behavior in the months and weeks preceding the events on Baldemnik. It was impossible to know how long Venomous's attack had been in the planning, but Tenebris, for all his cool detachment, had plainly worried over the decision. On Baldemnik, he had been distracted, and that inattention had cost him his life. But in those final moments, before he had fully grasped the role Plagueis had played, he had been on the verge of revealing the existence of Venomous. It made little difference now, and in fact Plagueis found the Bith's vacillation contemptible. Like Plagueis, Tenebris had obviously embraced the fact that Darth Bane's rule of two had expired. Precious few Sith Lords had honored it in any case, and with good reason, as Plagueis saw it. The goals of the Grand Plan were revenge and the reacquisition of galactic power. But while most Sith Lords since Bane had in their own fashion helped to weaken the Republic, their efforts had owed less to selflessness and allegiance to the rule than to weakness and incompetence. Driven to discharge Bane's imperative they might have been, and yet each had fallen prey to individual foibles and eccentricities, and so had failed to exact revenge on the Jedi Order. Plagueis understood. He would never have been one to lay in wait or devote his reign merely to positioning a subsequent Sith Lord for success. Nor would he have been content to remain in Tenebris' shadow as an apprentice had the Bith actually triumphed where others had failed. How, in all his wisdom, had Tenebris failed to grasp that Plagueis was the culmination of the millennium-long hunger for revenge? How had the Bith failed to grasp that destiny had called him? In a rare moment of compliment, the Bith had even said as much.
In the same way that tectonic forces cause a boulder to plunge into a river, forever diverting its course, events give rise to individuals whose stepping into the current of the Force alter the tide of history. You are such a one.
Was Plagueis now to believe that Tenebris had also considered Venomous such a one? If so, it demeaned him. The data discovered aboard Venomous's starship failed to shed light on how old he'd been when Tenebris found him, or reveal anything about his training. Set ways of training an apprentice were a thing of the past, regardless. Doctrine was for the Jedi. Where the Jedi courted power, the Sith lusted after it. Where the Jedi believed they knew the truth, the Sith possessed it. Owned by the dark side, they ultimately became their knowledge. For the past 500 years, the Sith of the Bane line had eschewed selecting children as apprentices, finding it more advantageous to discover beings who had already been hardened or scarred by life. Plagueis, though, had been an exception. Munilinst had not followed suit when, in the madness that was the Third Great Expansion, worlds of the Core and the Inner Rim had stretched out to settle and claim many of the planets surveyed and made available by the Colonization Act and the Planet Grant Amendment. The reason was simple. Though the Munes had wealth beyond the wildest dreams of many species and access to starships of the highest quality, they were unwilling to leave their holdings on Munilinst unattended. Nor were they interested in colonization for its own sake, in spreading their seed, because the more Munes the galaxy contained, the less wealth there would be to go around. Eventually, though, autarky and isolationism ceded to a desire to make themselves essential to the galaxy, and the Munes began to fund settlements established by other worlds or by independent groups, self-exiled as often as not. And so colonies at the distal end of the Braxent Run became dependent on Munilinst for support, borrowing against the promise of discovering rich veins of ore or precious metals. When, however, the purported treasures failed to materialize, or markets became saturated, resulting in lower prices, the careworn populations of those settlements found themselves hopelessly indebted to Munilinst and were forced to accept direct oversight by the Munes. So it happened that Plagueis' clan father, Kar Damask, came to be administrator of the treasure world of Magito. Located in Munilinst's own stellar neighborhood, and a fertile breeding ground for Nova, Artesian, and low-level Adigan crystals, Magito, Gem, as it was known in the ancient Mune tongue, was also one of the least hospitable worlds the Munes had acquired. Captive to snow and ice, the planet boasted few indigenous life forms and was continually assailed by storms that mounded its surface into crystal spurs the size of mountains. Regardless, and at great expense, the Munes had succeeded in constructing a few self-contained cities and storage vaults, powering them with energy derived from the crystals themselves. Even in the best of instances, Magito was a challenge to approach because of its asteroid ring. But the asteroids became secondary impediments once the intergalactic banking clan assumed control of mining operations in the ice shelves and glaciers. Then even the Jedi were prohibited from visiting without prior authorization. Already a member of long-standing in the IBC, the Elder Damask had accepted the assignment as a personal favor to Munilint's high officer, Mals Toneth, but more in the hope of advancing a career that had stalled and kept him confined to middle management. Unrecognized for his genius, and angry about it, Damask had left his primary wife and clanmates behind, and had attempted to build, if not a life, then at least a career for himself on the remote ice world. Success in supervising the mining operations came in short order, but contentment of any sort proved elusive until the arrival, 10 years after his own, of a lower caste Mune female, who would first become his assistant, then his codicil wife, in due course giving birth to a son they named Higo, after Kar's clan father. His upbringing in a domed city in a perpetually frozen environment was in many ways the antithesis of the typical Mune childhood, and yet young Higo managed not only to endure, but to prosper. His mother took what some considered to be an unhealthy interest in his development, recording every detail and encouraging him to share even his most furtive thoughts with her. She was especially interested in observing his interactions with playmates of diverse species, which she was never at a loss to provide, interrogating him after every session about his feelings about this or that youngling. Even Kar found time enough from a demanding schedule to be a doting parent. Higo was not yet 5 years old when he began to sense that he was somehow different. Not only was he more astute than his playmates, but he could often manipulate them, arousing laughter when he wished to, or just as often tears. Comfort just as often as anxiety. He learned to read intentions and body language. When he sensed that someone didn't like him, he would go out of his way to be generous. And when he sensed that someone liked him too much, he would occasionally go out of his way to be difficult, as a means of testing the limits of the relationship. He divined tricks and deceits, and sometimes allowed himself to play the victim, the dupe, out of concern for arousing unwanted suspicion, or being forced to reveal too much about his hidden talents. As his abilities increased, other children became playthings rather than playmates, but with no loss of enjoyment on Higo's part. One afternoon, a Mune youngster he had grown to dislike pushed his way past Higo in an effort to be first to reach a staircase that led down to the Damask home's lower-level courtyard. Grabbing his peer by the upper arm, Higo said, "If you're in such a rush to get downstairs, then jump out the window." Locking glances, Higo repeated the suggestion and his victim took it to heart. Many questions were asked after the youngling's broken body was discovered in the courtyard, but Higo kept the truth from everyone but his mother. She made him go over his explanation in increasing detail, until finally saying, "I've long suspected that you have the gift your father and I share. And now I know it to be true. It's a strange, wondrous power, Higo, and you have it in abundance. Your father and I have spent our lives keeping our gifts a closely guarded secret, and I want your word that for the time being you will speak of it only to me or to him. Later in life, this power will serve you well, but right now, it must remain undisclosed." Having lived a surreptitious life for so many years, Higo found the notion of sharing the secret only with his parents completely natural. No one held him responsible for his playmate's plunge from the window, but soon after, the steady stream of playmates began to dry up. Worse, his father began to grow distant, even while Higo found himself becoming more and more a part of Carr's world. He considered that his father might be lying about having the power, or had come to think of Higo as some kind of monster. And yet he observed his father employing his eldritch powers of persuasion and manipulation in business dealings. Like Munalinst, Maegito received many important visitors, and at times it struck Higo that, in lieu of his being able to explore the galaxy was coming to him. On several occasions, his father met with Jedi Knights and Padawans who came in search of Adigan crystals, which the Jedi Order used in the construction of training lightsabers. Higo had long since perfected his ability to mask his powers from others. Even without revealing his true nature to the Jedi, he was able to sense in them a kind of like-minded power, though one that was clearly at cross-purposes with his own. From early on, he knew that he could never be one of them, and he began to abhor their visits for reasons he couldn't grasp. Even more puzzling, he came to sense a power closer to his own in a Bith visitor named Rugis Gnome. Gnome wasn't a Jedi, but a starship engineer, who arrived in a luminous vessel of his own design. Before long, however, Higo began to suspect that his mother was the reason for Gnome's frequent visits, and the suspicion that there was something between them incited feelings of anger and jealousy in young Higo, and a kind of conflicted despondency in his father. Higo had made up his mind to bring his power to bear on the intolerable situation when, during one of Gnome's visits, he was summoned to his father's office, where Carr, his mother, and the Bith were waiting. Without looking at his wife, Carr had said, "You are of our blood, Higo, but we can no longer raise you as our progeny." Higo had looked from his father to his mother in mounting distress, fearing the very words Carr added a moment later. With a nod toward Gnome, he said, "In truth, and in ways that you will eventually come to understand, you belong to him." A decade later, Higo would learn that while Carr had in fact done his best to keep his force abilities to himself, he had come to the attention of Gnome when the two had chanced to meet on Highport Space Center. Years would pass before Gnome found Higo's mother, whom he had conscripted not as an apprentice, for she wasn't strong enough in the Force, but as a disciple whose task it had been to romance Carr and bear the fruit of that seduction, a child whom Gnome and Bith science predicted would be born strong in the Force. Higo's parents had safeguarded the secret until his power had begun to reveal itself, and then a deal had been brokered. Higo, in exchange for the realization of Carr Damask's lifelong dream of being accepted into the upper echelon of the intergalactic banking clan. 5 years after the revelation in the office, Carr was recalled to Munalinst to become director of the treasury branch of the IBC. Higo's mother vanished, never to be seen again by either husband or son. And Higo's apprenticeship to Sith Lord Darth Tenebris commenced. In addition to being widely respected as a savant engineer and starship designer, Rugis Gnome headed a shadowy organization that over the decades had gathered intelligence on the dealings of nearly every criminal, smuggler, pirate, and potential terrorist who had left a mark on the galaxy. With young Higo masquerading as Gnome's accountant, the two secret Sith had traveled widely, often conspiring with the galaxy's most notorious beings and facilitating anarchy whenever possible.
"We Sith are an unseen opposition," Tenebris had told his young apprentice. "A phantom menace. Where the Sith once wore armor, we now wear cloaks. But the Force works through us all the more powerfully in our invisibility. For the present, the more covert we remain, the more influence we can have. Our revenge will be achieved not through subjugation, but by contagion."
As Tenebris explained it, the Jedi had emerged strong from the war of a millennium earlier, and while Darth Bane and subsequent Sith Lords had done their best to disrupt the reborn Republic, they labored at a disadvantage. So eventually it was decided that the Sith should hide in plain sight, amassing wealth and knowledge, and securing contacts and alliances with groups that would one day form the basis of a galaxy-wide opposition to both the Republic and the revered order that served it. By all accounts, those early centuries had been challenging, watching the Jedi return to their imminent position. But the Sith had had the luxury of studying the Order from afar, without the Jedi ever being aware that they had adversaries. The rend that Tenebris's Twi'lek master had opened in the fabric of the Force had been felt by the Jedi, and already the Order was beginning to show signs of circumspection and languor. The Republic, too, had been similarly undermined by encouraging corruption in the Senate and lawlessness in the Outer Rim systems, which had become the dumping grounds for the Core. With the wretched of the galaxy being converted to the cause, the powerful would now need to be brought together, with Darth Plagueis as their leader, manipulating the actions of an important few to control the behavior of countless trillions.